This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you don't live in the type of housing we're about to discuss, you may live in it soon, since it's the fastest-growing form of housing. It's called the Common Interest Development, and it includes condominiums, co-ops, and planned unit developments. Everybody who buys a unit is required to join a homeowners association. My guest, Evan McKenzie, says these homeowners associations are like private governments, and these new communities are a hybrid of utopian ideals and American privatism. He calls them privatopias. McKenzie is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In his new book, Privatopia, he raises questions about the social and economic impact of these communities. He says new buyers are sometimes surprised to find their new home comes along with over 100 pages of rules and regulations restricting their behavior. Here are some examples.
A large number of them are architectural restrictions that say such things as you can't paint your house any color except beige or blue or some earth tone, something like that. Restrictions on fences, saying that you can't build a fence or that if you do, you have to seek permission to do it. Restrictions on planting gardens, hanging things from your windows. And then, in addition to architectural restrictions, there are frequently behavioral restrictions. For example, restrictions on having pets. Many communities say you can't have children or you can't have anyone living in the development below a certain age, say 45 years of age. Restrictions on having parties past a certain time. In some cases, you can't have more than a certain number of people in your unit without seeking the permission of the association first. And then where there are private streets in many of these developments, they frequently enforce private speed limits so that you can actually ultimately be not only fined but banned from your development for repeat speeding offenses in your community.
And you point out that the homeowners associations can limit behavior without regard to constitutional rights. Why is that?
Well, that's because homeowner associations are private organizations, usually private corporations, and the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution only applies to what we call state action, or in other words, it protects individuals against the actions of government, either the national government in Washington or the states or the cities in which people live. So if private organizations engage in activities that infringe on constitutional liberties, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, really doesn't apply to what they do. Courts view homeowner association activity as though you had joined the Kiwanis Club or something of that sort, and that's a private organization. If you don't like their rules, if they say you have to wear a certain kind of hat to their meeting or whatever, the courts say, well, that's consensual conduct, that's private activity. You're not faced with the tyranny of a government here, and so you don't need the Bill of Rights to protect you, and so you don't have it to protect you, even though many of the things homeowner associations do are very similar to what cities do.
What do you call these kinds of developments, privatopia?
There's a real utopian strain in this type of housing that goes back well over about 100 years, really. And you can trace that fairly accurately if you go back and look at works written in the 1890s and the early part of this century. And many people, when they started developing this type of housing, thought they had really hit upon the ideal way to live. And I think if you look at the marketing of this type of housing, you get a kind of utopian strain in the present day, that they sort of tell people, you know, this is the best place to live. It may not be heaven on earth, but it's as close as you're going to get. And I think and their path to that is through privatizing the functions of local government and putting them in the hands of homeowner associations.
Now, do you see the privatizing aspect as being at odds with the utopian aspect?
I think we really need to ask some serious questions about this, because it may be that many people who live in this type of housing think they've found utopia, and that the way they found it is through getting away from government, getting away from the cities. And there's a real anti-government strain in a lot of the rhetoric that I hear about homeowner associations from people who live in them sometimes and like them. But when people set themselves apart from society and live in a separate and distinct way according to a separate and distinct set of rules, while we may say people should have the right to do that, I think we have to ask about the consequences to the larger society of large numbers of people doing that. You know, if it were a few hundred people doing it, that would be one thing. If it's many, many, many people doing it, that's another question. In two senses. First, for the people who live there. If a small group of people go set up their own society and they're happy living that way, that's fine. But when large numbers of people are essentially drafted into living in this type of housing because they can't find affordable housing in their areas other than CID housing, they may not want this type of living, but they may be forced into it for economic reasons. So for them, these restrictions may not be utopia. And then what about the larger society? I think we should ask questions about the impact of having 30, 40, 50, 60 million people eventually living in large part outside the urban community as we know it.
Yeah, well, what about the larger social impact of that? Do you see the people who live in these common interest developments as seceding from the larger government?
I think many of them perceive it that way, yes. And, you know, it sets up a situation in which I think it encourages people to see themselves that way. The sort of epitome of this type of community is the gated, walled community with the security gates and private streets that you can't enter without permission. And so it's physically set apart from other people. And then economically, when you live in a development like this, you know, you're essentially taxed. They call them assessments by your association to maintain the common areas and to reserve large amounts of money for future repairs to the property. And that's all sound business practice, but, you know, it imposes an extra economic burden on the people who live in these communities. In some cases, they're paying $250, $350 a month in assessments. And that's a lot of money, especially when you add it onto your property tax. Now, they may get things for that, private pools, recreation facilities, and so forth, and those may be nice things, an extra security. But when it comes time to pay their property tax bill, many people in this industry have been saying, you know, this is what they call double taxation. And they're arguing that you should not have to pay property tax and to support public facilities and private assessments to support private facilities that duplicate them. Now, you know, we might say, well, gee whiz, you know, you get to use those public facilities too. But nonetheless, this is a powerful economic incentive for people to say, hey, we want special tax breaks. In other words, we want not to pay property taxes. We would rather pay just our own assessments to our own little private government. We don't want to pay to support public facilities. And that cry has been heard throughout the country from CID residents and their representatives in the legislatures.
Well, what impact do you think it would have on city governments and townships if the people in these community in these common interest developments stopped paying taxes or paid less taxes?
If homeowner assessments were fully deductible from property tax, it would be something on the order of $20 to $30 billion in lost revenues to the cities and counties across the country. And in particular, the areas that are heavily impacted by this type of housing, where it has just blossomed in just in an incredible rate, such as Orange County in California, parts of Florida, Texas, the Bay Area in the San Francisco Bay Area, parts of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania suburbs, say Valley Forge and so forth, those particular areas where there are large amounts of housing, where maybe 60, 70, 80% of the housing that has been built in the last 20 years is this type of housing, those cities and counties could literally become insolvent if they lost all that tax revenue. So in certain areas, the impact could be colossal.
My guest is Evan McKenzie, and he's the author of a new book called Privatopia, Homeowner Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Evan McKenzie, and we're talking about homeowners associations and common interest developments. He's the author of the new book, Privatopia. Now, you're worried about people who belong to these developments basically trying to secede from their local governments. But on the other hand, aren't a lot of the local governments really pleased with these common interest developments? Because it means the government doesn't have to worry about building the roads or handling the sewage system or even providing security there, because that's all privatized.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Hand in hand with the large-scale real estate developers who build this type of housing has been local government in the Sun Belt, typically, and in the rapidly growing areas, the so-called edge cities, as Joel Garreau calls them, of the country. They have, and the reason is, of course, because they've been in a major fiscal crisis that started in the mid-70s, where they have a really difficult time maintaining their existing infrastructure, much less building new infrastructure for new residents. So when a developer comes along and says, I'd like to build a development with 500 homes in it, and the city turns to them and says, well, now, wait a minute. That means we have to build a new school and a new park, and we have to build streets and roads and sewer hookups and all these other things. And the developer says, wait a minute. You don't have to build any of it. I'll build all that. And it will be owned and maintained by the homeowner association, or in some cases deeded to the public, but generally maintained by the people who live there. And then the city says, you mean we get all these taxpayers, property taxpayers, without having to build infrastructure? Wonderful, and it's a great deal. And so they have essentially collaborated to a large extent. However, now they are, in some areas are beginning to question that decision, because now that those residents are getting organized politically, which is happening across the country, now they are demanding special tax breaks. Now they're saying, we don't want to pay property taxes. We don't want to pay. We have duplicate services. The city say, well, that's why we let you build this developer. The developer's, of course, long gone. And now it's taken over by the residents. And they say they have an unfair tax burden. Well, that tax burden was placed on them by the developer in the city. That was the condition for building them in the first place.
What's the advantage to developers of building residents that have the common space, where the developer has to take the responsibility for the infrastructure and the roads and all that? Why would they want to take that much on instead of just building a bunch of homes?
Well, because there are great economies of scale in building this way. In fact, this type of housing, although it's been around for over 100 years, began to become popular in the early 1960s. And the reason was because the supply of suburban land was beginning to shrink, because there had been so much housing constructed from 1946 at the end of World War II through the early 60s that really the land cost, the cost to the developer of just buying and preparing the land on which these houses were built, was becoming really oppressive for them. So they were faced with a problem. Either they had to raise the price of housing, which threatened to put it out of reach of the middle class. People would not be able to afford to buy these houses if they priced them properly. Or they had to shrink the size of the lots. But people really had become accustomed to living in these large Ozzie and Harriet-style homes with their own yards. It's very hard to increase density for Americans because they're kind of used to having their own turf. So they hit upon this idea. They went back to the old idea of the planned communities that had been built early in the century, luxury subdivisions for the wealthy mostly. And they began to turn to what they called cluster subdivisions. And this is where the CID concept really took off in the early 1960s. It was embraced by the Federal Housing Administration. And essentially, it enables them to do this. They can squeeze more people on less land because, so for several reasons. First, you give people small yards instead of big yards, but then give them a commonly owned open space on which everyone can play, so they don't need a big yard. You shrink the size of the streets. Now, if the city builds a street or owns a street, they will not let you build it too narrowly because people can't park and drive on it. But if it's a private street, it can be very narrow. And that allows the developer to put more houses in the development because the streets are narrower. All these things are big cost savings for the developer. And it is true that they have to incur the capital cost up front of doing that, but the maintenance cost all gets passed on to the owners. So essentially, the developers save money on the construction. That's one of the main reasons they do it, and they can put more houses on less land.
You know, you've made the point that the homeowners associations aren't subjected to adhering to the Constitution because they're private groups. And it's understood that the people who belong to the homeowners associations are doing it out of choice. It's like joining a club or something. It's a private organization. But you say that it's not always so much of a choice. Sometimes you have no choice but to live in a place like this because it's all you can afford or because it's all that's available. Were you ever in a predicament like that where you had to move to a common interest development even though you didn't want to because you had no choice?
No, I was not forced to do that. Had I been, in the course of looking for work, for example, suppose I ended up working in Orange County, California, I would find myself in a place where 80% of the housing that has been built in the last 15 to 20 years is common interest housing. If I were teaching at the University of California at Irvine or someplace like that, it would be almost an impossible task to find housing that's not this type of housing. The exception would be if I had a tremendous amount of money, because if you want the old traditional single family style house, they're still available in most places, but in these areas where this type of housing has been built, typically property values are high. That's why they're building it. They're building it there, A, because the developers like to build in places with high property values, and secondly, because one of the goals with common interest housing is to make it a little bit more affordable so that middle class people can afford to buy it. So I might be able to find this type of housing if I had a lot of money to do it, or if I were willing to commute an enormous distance. But, you know, all these things are factors that tend to channel people toward common interest housing.
My guest is Evan McKenzie. He's the author of the new book, Privatopia. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Evan McKenzie, author of the new book Privatopia, Homeowners Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. Now, you're an academic, you're a professor, but you're also a lawyer, and in fact, I believe you have represented homeowners associations.
That's right, I did, for about 5 to 6 years.
In what kinds of fights?
In lawsuits against developers alleging that the development had been constructed with defects in it, that was physically defective in some way, that the soils were collapsing or expanding and cracking the foundations, that the roofs leaked, that the windows leaked, that in one case the whole development was built on top of an ancient landslide that was moving and destroying the homes gradually. It's called construction defect lawsuits, and I represented homeowner associations in that type of suit for a number of years.
Did your work representing homeowners associations lead to looking at common interest developments as a larger social issue?
Yes, it did. That's just what happened. I began to meet the directors of these associations as I started working on this type of case, and I started realizing that just this enormous responsibility had fallen upon these ordinary citizens. And I started thinking, how in the world did this happen? I was about halfway through doing my graduate work in political science, and I was practicing law at the time. And so I was attuned to the concept in political science that we call private government. It's been a concept in political science for decades. And I suddenly, it just hit me right in the face. These are private governments. These people are doing, they're running small cities. And it just shocked me because here would be these ordinary people. They work all day. They have a job. They're secretaries or they're in some cases lawyers, or they work in, they sell cars, sell insurance. And then they've been elected to run this little city in which they live. There's nobody supporting them, nobody training them. Nobody tells them how to do it. They're totally reliant on me as their lawyer or a property manager to tell them what to do, and suddenly they're confronted, in this the cases I was involved with what might be a tremendous amount of money. They have to make a decision about millions of dollars. Should we settle this case? Should we go to trial and risk losing everything? Should we pay an expert $100,000 to do an investigation of this problem that we have here? And the responsibility was enormous, and they were so dependent on their lawyers to tell them what to do. I started thinking about this very hard, and I started thinking, this really needs to be looked at. I looked around, and there was very little written on the subject, and except for industry publications, and so I thought it would be good to give it an academic treatment, and that's what I did with my dissertation and then later the book.
So you're giving us warnings now about the larger social repercussions of these privatized governments and homeowners associations. Why should anyone care who doesn't live with a homeowners association and doesn't plan on moving into such a development?
Well, for two reasons. One is you're liable to find yourself living in one. People, because the former president of the largest trade association in this industry said a couple of years ago, he gave a speech in Canada. He said by the year 2000, 25% to 30% of Americans will be living in homeowner associations. What people don't understand is that the real estate industry, the large-scale developers who build most of our housing, have overwhelmingly embraced this concept. This is what they're building, mm-hmm. and in the rapidly growing parts of the country. So people are liable to find themselves sucked into a development like this, almost like a vacuum cleaner, whether they like it or not. Market logic may force them into it. And so that's a question. Secondly, if you live in any city in America that has a large concentration of homeowner associations, you need to start thinking about the tax consequences, about the political consequences. I mean, for example, if there is going to be a bond issue floated for to build a park in the city, and 40% of the people in the jurisdiction live in a homeowner association with or associations with their own parks, are they going to vote in favor of building a public park or not? Or will they be inclined to say, we have a park, we don't need to vote for a public park? So particularly when they're paying hundreds of dollars per month in assessments. Are they going to make a demand for rebates? The whole state of New Jersey is currently giving rebates to all the people who live in homeowner associations. That's going to affect the people who don't. That is going to have dramatic impact on the people of the state of New Jersey. That just went into effect this year. So I really think that everyone is impacted by this, whether they realize it or not. And everyone is impacted by the overall phenomenon of the privatization of public life. That is affecting us all at this moment, culturally, politically, socially.
Evan McKenzie, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Evan McKenzie is the author of Privatopia. He teaches political science at the University of Chicago at Illinois.